Hello, everyone, and welcome back for another episode of the Endless Spiral podcast. I am, as always, your host, Keith Russell. This is the mental health show where I speak to everyone and anyone with a story to tell, as well as getting advice from experts in their chosen fields. In this episode, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by TV host, entrepreneur, stylist, and most importantly, a dog lover, Mr. Darren Kennedy. So, so how are you, Darren? Thanks very much for coming on for a chat.
I'm actually very good today because my poor little dog Harry was booked in for surgery yesterday. Funny you should mention him. Yeah. And he'll be 16 years old this year. He's a teacup Yorkie, and anyone who follows me on social media will be very familiar with him. But he had to have he had to get knocked out and get some teeth taken out yesterday. So I was really worried because you know when they get to that age, you don't want you don't want to really be putting your dog under unnecessarily. But he was getting this. I think he had an abscess. But anyway, all is good in the world. It's good. It's actually quite interesting because I found with Harry, I started getting. Like during the lockdown, I hate to even go back to talking about lockdowns, but I live alone and Harry like was my kind of constant companion as he has been for like the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I remember after a few months getting really anxious about something happening to him, you know, like it was kind of, it was weird. I'd never had that feeling before. But anyway, Harry is good and I'm glad to be here. How are you?
I'm good. You know what? Speaking of little Harry, right? We have a sausage dog, like a Dachshund, and he's 13. He's probably more than 13. And he actually has all his teeth out. And but he's blind. Because he's a diabetic, he went blind. And we have to give him an injection every morning and every evening.
Wow.
And I do another podcast, and it's more of a lighthearted podcast, and we just tell stories and we have a laugh. And on the other podcast, every episode, I have a fainting story. I'm quite known to faint when needles are around. And I told a story yesterday, and I'll say it to you now, I'm just kind of coming to my head there. His name is Cola, and he's a sausage dog, so he's small, and I lifted him up on the counter because he's starting to wiggle about now when he's getting his needle. And I thought he was going to jump off the countertop. So I grabbed him, you know, just to stop him falling off. And then I stabbed myself in the chest with the insulin needle.
And did the insulin go into you?
No, luckily I'd already given it to him.
Oh my God.
I said that to the wife and she's like, you absolute moron. Because as soon as I stabbed myself with the needle, I was like, okay, that's me gone. I'm going to faint now. Because it just...
You're able to... give the injection.
Yeah, he was my other co-host in the pod was asking me the same things. So I suppose as long as the needle's not going into me, I'm not really sure. It's only it's a tiny little small needle. But like I was saying to the wife, and she was just picturing herself coming into the kitchen. I'm unconscious on the kitchen floor, the needle sticking out my chest, and the dog sitting on the countertop.
Not a visual, I'm sure she wants to encounter.
She would have found it funny. But anyway, look, we'll move on from dogs. That's not my dog story anyway.
I love it.
Yeah. Anyway, look, this is a mental health podcast, right? So, and I usually do start off by asking the guests how they've been through lockdown anyway. And you've kind of answered that anyway. But I did read somewhere only recently that you were saying that you were actually feeling quite anxious at the beginning of lockdown. Is that right?
Yeah, I was, in a way that I'd never really experienced before. A certain low level, I guess, anxiety started to creep up, and it was all about the usual things being taken away from you in life, or the things that you previously thought that you had control over, where really you didn't, you know, but in your own head or whatever, you felt that maybe you did. And understanding that kind of work and my life and what I've done for the past 10 or 15 years is very much realizing now, very much fast paced, like very much on the go, meeting new people, constantly kind of entering new environments. And it's something that I thrive on, like I really enjoy and adore coming home to the kind of sanctuary of my own home and closing the door and being, you know, being still as well. But then when that was taken away, I did find it really, really slightly suffocating and claustrophobic and, you know, understanding more about myself and how I operate and about what kind of gives me energy. So I did, for a while. And I think, you know, most people, if they're being honest, did suffer some degree of anxiety just about the change and change, you know, and it was change that no one understood or no one knew what was what was to come or what wasn't to come. So yeah, I think it was never debilitating. It was never something that I couldn't kind of get my head around. But it was an interesting experience and gave me an insight into, I feel, people who do really suffer with anxiety on to a degree that it prevents them from maybe, you know, functioning regularly. And that must be challenging.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, actually, because it's amazing how, because I've asked kind of lots of people the same question, and it's amazing how many different kind of answers you get. So for some people who kind of live with anxiety all the time, including myself, I've nearly turned into a borderline recluse, because you've been at home for so long, you kind of just get comfortable and you nearly don't want to go out then, where you have other people where they're used to going out all the time and they were feeling anxious being at home, where I was nearly feeling anxious with the thoughts of having to go back out again, you know?
Yeah.
But like when you were at home, did you do anything for yourself? Like, did you, like I'm talking about like maybe mindfulness, or, you know, did you feel isolated or lonely?
Yeah, I did. No, I stayed very connected, obviously, with family and friends. Daily FaceTime calls and that type of thing. And I do have neighbors, and I'd make sure that I'd see them. And actually, Harry, the dog, was a lifesaver on so many levels, because obviously he's company, but it's also his routine as well. So every morning, obviously, he needs to be walked, he needs to be fed in the afternoon, the evening. So you built up, it gave me purpose to get out of the house, because very rapidly, the motivation can go, but obviously he had his needs, so that kind of kept me going, and was a nice way then of bumping into neighbors whatever you might have. But and then I, you know, like everyone, I tried to, you know, maintain some level of fitness.
Yeah, I saw a picture of you on Instagram of your you took some dumbbells and a kettlebell and a mat there, and I suppose that's all you can do, really, isn't it?
Yeah, so I got some of the equipment, but like, you'd be sick looking at it, you know that way. And they got progressively shorter and shorter and shorter, to the point that like sometimes it was like literally 5 minutes, and then I'm like, I'm done. But I always think, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes is better than no minutes.
That's exactly what it is. That's 100%. I'm glad you said that, because I've had an awful relationship with exercise for a long time. And it was only when I kind of doing this podcast and speaking to experts and that, and that, you know, you kind of just give yourself a bit of a break. And instead of putting so much pressure on myself to go, right, I have to do, you know, I have a treadmill there, so I have to do a certain amount of calories, I have to go on it for a certain amount of time, I have to do all this and that. I just started introducing yoga. You know, I've never done yoga in my life, but as you said, just go do 5-10 minutes on, you know, of anything really. And the nutritionist that I spoke to, she kept on giving out to me for using the word exercise. She prefers the word movement, because it's a lot less stressful to say movement, you know?
Movement can be housework. I say fitness, actually.
Yeah, fitness, exactly, yeah.
It's like, it's, you know, it's as much as you take care of your mind, it's taking care of your machine, which is your body, you know? And it's, I always think it's, you know, taking care of that, it's what allows me to get up out of bed in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
So, and also I think it is important to remove the pressure from it. Like, I think we sometimes have this mentality that it's all or nothing. So unless, for example, I do 30 minutes on the treadmill, well, then it's not a good workout. And then you kind of almost talk yourself off it. Yeah. Whereas if you say, you know what, I'm going to do 5 and see how I feel, you might end up doing 35, but you might not. And that's also okay.
Yeah, that's exactly. You know what? You're absolutely dead right. And you know, you mentioned the machine. I read a quote that you said. It was an analogy, and I'm going to read it because it's exactly kind of similar to what you just said. You said mental health is like a car. If your tires are low, you're still going to move, and you're still going to function. But if that continues, it's going to become dangerous. I read that earlier on. I just thought it was a great analogy to use a car, because it's dead right, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, and sometimes cars come to a stop as well. So it's and I, you know, I have to say as well, I do understand that, you know, to put so far in my life, I don't think I've ever really suffered from depression in a serious way. And I do have people in my life who do suffer. So I'm talking it just from my perspective, and I never try to underestimate what someone else is going through and the kind of chemically or physiologically the impact that has on them, because I don't fully understand that. I probably have had episodic periods of depression, which I think everyone does, because I think to feel depressed at times is part of the human state, but then to go into full-on depressions, I don't have experience of that. So, you know, I'm always very conscious when we talk about anything to do with mental health that I can only talk about from my perspective, and I never want to be perceived as diminishing someone else's experience, you know, because I can't understand that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if anyone ever asks me for advice, I always say, oh, look, I can only give you my experience and my personal, you know, opinion on things. I'm exactly the same. But you've been quite outspoken, or maybe not outspoken is the wrong word, but been quite open anyway about speaking about men's mental health in general. Is that something you kind of feel that just is maybe lacking behind?
Yeah, I mean, definitely in the past couple of years, I do feel it's advancing. And even, you know, this podcast and, you know, Movember and how they pivoted from kind of like their original original kind of mandate, which was like testicular cancer, and how they've grown over the years, and like mental health has been at the forefront of everything they do. And I think, I just think it's still something that we as in men don't often feel we have license to talk about, or don't feel comfortable talking about it, because there isn't necessarily a comfortable space to do so. And, you know, there is still something in our culture that, you know, men are strong, and a sign of strength is shut up and, you know, don't express how you're feeling or your emotions and just get on with it. And that's dangerous.
I was speaking to someone in Bodywise, and they were saying that, I mean, their statistics will prove this and shows this, but like, so many men go undiagnosed, like myself. I don't know if you're familiar with my story, but I was silent for 20 odd years on things, and I've only started sharing my story in the last year. And I've lived with kind of body dysmorphia and all that, you know, for a long time. But because of you, as you said, like with the stigma and, you know, men feeling they have to look or feel or come across a certain way, men just go undiagnosed for so long. And there's data in the UK that say something like 75% of suicides are men. Like, it's just, it's amazing, isn't it? It's just real, you know.
And same in Ireland. I definitely know the statistics in relation to suicide, like, it skews far heavier male than female.
And I saw you say that you sometimes you feel a little uneasy speaking about mental health or men's mental health, because you feel like people are going to think you're just looking for attention, or you're jumping on a bandwagon, and that's awful. That's a terrible to feel, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been something I was maybe conscious of, but then, you know, I think for me, I'd speak about something because I want to speak about something and it means something to me. So I guess it's understanding that my motive is never to get attention, but it's to bring awareness. So there is a difference there. And I had to actually take stock and look at that once, because I was like, I would hate to feel that, you know, people think you're doing something for the wrong reasons. Jesus, no. I just think it's important, you know, that, and I obviously growing up had, I was great at like putting up a facade and not talking and not expressing what was really going on with me and within my mind. And even now, you know, you still go through periods now. Like, I don't think you ever become immune to it. And that's what I mean. It's like, and to bring it back to the physical, it's like, wouldn't it be amazing to work out for a week and then whatever gains you had then, just you could press pause and that was it for life. It's the same with your mental health, you know. You have to constantly work on it, and hopefully you build up that kind of mental resilience and that ability to kind of snap yourself back where you need to go. And listen, I've had challenges more recent than you might think, but it's about understanding them and kind of taking the time. And I'm a big believer in therapy. And if people can access therapy, I think it's something that, you know, I would advise anyone to do. And I often think as well, and I know this through my own experience with friends and stuff, people think you do therapy when things are bad, and then once everything's fine, you stop. I actually think it's nearly more important to keep it going when everything's fine, because you're keeping that side of things in check, and it's an outlet. So if anything, even if you've no one that you feel you can speak to in your life once a week, you have, you know, that outlet, and it can actually be a real stress reliever.
Yeah, I mean, and even going to, if you, as you said, if you can go to therapy, I mean, I know there's an awful lot of talk in Ireland that, you know, the waiting list to go public and all that type of stuff, you know, can go on and on and yes. on, and that's awful, and so people just can't get to it. But if you do and you can go privately,
there are great facilities online now. They're great, like online. That's the thing that, you know, obviously one of the benefits of the pandemic is you can have a Zoom session with someone, and it doesn't, and it's like they have the, you know, they're much more accessible.
Affordable,
because I do understand it is obviously it can be a big financial thing, and not everyone, you know, can access that. But
but even going and not leaving it too late to go, which is what probably most men will probably do. You know, like, I mean, when you feel that there's something coming on, or, you know, just not leaving it too late. This with what men, and I'm talking about me as well, you know, exactly what you said. When it's nearly too late, you go, and when you feel like you're better, you stop. You know.
Yeah, and do you know what? Like, that's just, and I don't. I mean, for me, it's like I will keep kind of touching base with the person. Like, I won't necessarily do weekly sessions, but it might be every 6 weeks. I go, do you know, can we just check in? And personally, I find that beneficial.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. And it's amazing, like, even if you feel completely fine and there's nothing to talk about, you'll find that you probably have lots to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. It's the times when you think you've nothing to say where you've probably more to say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's an Irish thing or something, you know, with just not going or something. I mean, I know you're in the States and all, but then maybe that's more. I think it's more of a thing to go to a therapist. I'm not really sure. Maybe I just watch too much American TV shows.
I definitely think it's much more of like people will kind of throw it out there. There's less stigma associated to it. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
But for me, it was no. I started, there was, you know, lots of change and lots of things going on in my life 5 or 6 years ago. And I thought, you know what, I'm gonna see a therapist. And it's something that I've maintained. And I do feel is, and to go back to that analogy of, you know, taking care of your mind is equally, if not more important, of taking care of your body, because we all know how powerful the mind can be. And it can be a scary place if you lose control of it.
Exactly. And just even like losing control, or another way of putting it, is exactly where I got the name for this podcast, The Endless Spiral. I used to always feel that I was caught in an endless spiral. That my mind would spiral. That's exactly what it was, you know? What I was going to ask you is, if I just go back to Movember for a second, how did you get involved with them, or did they approach you?
Yeah, they approached me last year to be an ambassador for the campaign. And it was very much, so it was the first Movember, obviously, to happen during the pandemic. And it was like, how do you reach people? And obviously, it felt like we were coming to a bit of a crisis point. And so I ended up working with them on that. And then I was delighted to see that how much the kind of whole organization had pivoted in terms of a broader scope of men's mental health. While you know, the testicular cancer and checking yourself and all that was still part of the messaging, it was very much about, you know, pick up the phone, check in on a buddy, and, you know, create space for conversation, which I think was interesting. Not just like, oh, how are you? Yeah, I'm grand. How are you? Yeah, grand. And moving on. It's like just genuinely creating space. Like, how are you doing? And being aware that, you know, someone who maybe is normally quite gregarious and always in touch, if someone goes quiet, just being sensitive to those little cues, which can be signs that someone might be struggling.
Just, you know, lending an ear to somebody. But I know the reason why I asked you about the Movember, because I did something with Movember last year as well, and it was a photo shoot, and it was like about 10 of us that went to do it. And but as you said, it wasn't all about testicular cancer. Like, it was everyone nearly had a different story to tell. And it was fantastic. You do a bit with Dogs Trust as well, do you? I saw you doing something with them.
I do, yeah. I'm an ambassador with Dogs Trust. You know, as I said at the beginning of the conversation, like, dogs have been such an important part of my life for my entire life. We've always had dogs, and I've always kind of really attached to them, animals in general, to be honest. And I mean, I help out where I can. I've done various things to them. I mean, the most bizarre, well, not bizarre, was kind of amazing and bizarre, was they celebrated 125 years, believe it or not, of the Dogs Trust a couple of years ago. Yeah, they're around that long. I kind of hosted a soiree and a fundraiser in Annabelle's, which is a real swanky kind of pub in Mayfair in London. And it was like very, very, very well-heeled individuals. And I remember there was an auction. Some lord carried out this auction. He was very good. And it always sticks at me. Someone paid, I think it was like 25,000 sterling for the naming rights of a yet unborn litter of puppies. I remember going, wow, okay, that's support. But people love animals, you know. And I think if someone doesn't like dogs, I'll be always wary of them.
Yeah. I used to work for the ISPCA. I used to do kind of all their digital stuff and that. And yeah, exactly the same. You see some stuff that used to, you know, come into us through emails that we, you know, from the website and that, and just like, you know, cruelty animals, now it's terrible, it's shocking, really is awful. I don't know how some people can do it, I really don't. Go on, yeah.
No, I agree. Like, it's I just can't stand this, but I never will.
Yeah, exactly. A quick question for you, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but do you feel a need to maybe look a certain way, knowing you're kind of in the public eye, or just, you know, like I'm gonna get photographs taken a lot or whatever, you know, on TV? Do you feel anxious, or do you feel like you need to look a certain way?
I don't feel anxious about it, but I'm aware that, you know, in terms of, well, I'm not going to like look scruffy if I'm doing something like doing a job or whatever. Like, I would be aware of that. And, you know, I do enjoy, like, obviously, I really enjoy style and how things look, and that's just the way I've been from a very young age. I love, you know, assembling a room and you know, making it feel cozy and aesthetically pleasing, and the same would apply to like how I get dressed in the morning. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say no, because obviously it's just part and parcel of what I do. And then in terms of fitness, that for me is part of my lifestyle. And I think that's the key. And that was something that I kind of instigated and I'd always kind of played a bit of sport and various things, but I went out on my own. I'd left kind of full-time employment and had gone freelance about 15 years ago. Yeah. And that was kind of a scary thing to do. And that's before people were working from home. Like, I had started working from home 15 years ago. And one of the things I really found very early on was that it was very lonely and isolating. So I had to kind of put structure points in my day. And one of them was actually going to the gym. So like mid-morning or whatever, going to the gym and having that outlet and meeting people and having that bit of structure in your day. So that was really good for my mental health, actually. And then also, you know, taking care of myself for me. And so that's kind of how I look at it at this point. There were different times in my life where I probably did feel pressure, definitely. When I first started attending like fashion weeks in London and Paris and whatnot, and you do like, there were people there and you're like, oh my God. And, you know, you can fall into the trap of comparison. And that can be, there was definitely a period where I did feel pressure. But not anymore. Like, it's a different, I guess I'm in a different space now, and understanding that, you know, my value is, it goes beyond that, you know. And it's all about your own self-worth and self-value as well, and understanding.
Yeah, exactly. So you do it because you want to do it rather than because you feel like you have to do it, if you know what I mean, which is great.
It makes me feel good.
Yeah. Brilliant. Amazing. Yeah. Because like I said earlier on, I had such an unhealthy relationship with food and exercise. Like, I lived with body dysmorphia for like 20 odd years. I didn't even know the term existed until last year, you know, and that's all of a sudden like a light bulb went off over my head. I was like, Jesus Christ, I've been living with this. Have you ever had any issues with body dysmorphia, or have you ever even heard much about it?
Body dysmorphia, I've obviously heard of. For me, it was more about definitely when I was in kind of my later teenage years and kind of coming to terms with who I was and where I felt very outcast almost, you know, like not belonging, and then kind of struggling with identity and that type of thing. And then I kind of, the control aspect of that for me came down to trying to control what I ate, and or restricting what I ate. And that was something that I kind of grappled with for a couple of years. And every now and again, you kind of, you feel it might rear its head, but it's, again, it's understanding and knowing actually, well, for me, the most important thing is being kind to myself and staying fit. So I understand what works for my body, in the sense that, like, I know if I eat a tub of Ben and Jerry's every night of the week for a week, I'm not going to feel good about myself. If I do it one night, that's fine.
Yeah, complete yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, at the moment, I'm probably a little bit further down the scale of like eating. I know I kind of get addicted to sweet treats as well. The more I have, the more I want, you know. Yeah. But yeah, so it's, again, it's a bit understanding kind of for me what was happening behind that.
Are you comfortable talking about your battles with an eating disorder when you were younger?
Yeah, you see, I always feel strange saying that because I never was diagnosed with an eating disorder. No one knew, because I was very clever about keeping it to myself. And I was in the middle of three children, and there was lots of things going on in our household. And the one thing that they always knew, or at least thought they knew, was that Darren loves his food. And Darren, you know, the one thing he won't do is go hungry. And I remember we were at a family event, and like, and I do actually have a very naturally big appetite, and I do love my grub. And, you know, even every day now, every meal is something I look forward to. And I remember someone in my extended family made a comment when I was 15 about, oh, you know, God, he's got a huge, great appetite, doesn't he? That's fine now, but that'll catch up on him in a few years. And that stuck in my head. And I remember thinking, okay. And I took note of that. And that grew into something for me. And again, that was linked with identity, coming to terms with my sexuality. All these things kind of became intertwined. But one thing I could take control of was that, you know, what I was consuming. So yeah, so for a couple of years in my late teens, I definitely went through a phase, I'd say probably 2 years, where I just like dropped loads of weight. And was delighted with it, because again, it wasn't necessarily about the physical. It was more about knowing that I could control it.
All right. Gotcha. Okay. Right. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's interesting.
Yeah. For me, that was it. And then also because I didn't want to be like, I didn't want to be, you know, overweight. But that was coming then from another angle. There was lots of different angles there.
But isn't it amazing how, like, a simple and an innocent comment that no one probably meant anything by just sticks in, you know, in your head, isn't it?
And that's, you know, that's why there is kind of a movement now that, you know, you shouldn't ever really make any comment about anyone's physicality, good or bad. You know, when someone's intentions are purely, you know, innocent, you kind of feel, you know, even with people go, oh my God, you look great. Have you lost weight? You know, that's meant to, people say that obviously with the purest of intentions.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that can be read as, oh my God, was I fat before? Did I not look good before? Et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's kind of know who you're talking to.
Yeah, exactly. Because I suppose, that's exactly what it is. Everyone can take things differently, and also depends on the person's state of mind, obviously, you know. So, like I used to get, you know, like comments like that, I used to always hear like, there's not a pick on you.
Yeah.
And it used to drive me mad because I'm like, because I used to like with the body dysmorphia, I used to like fixate on a spare tire like I thought I had. And like when someone's like, oh, there isn't a pick on you, you're like, well, I know it's there. You know, like I mean, and you would really just kind of just get at you, you know?
I think it's important to say as well. And so body dysmorphia and eating disorders amongst men is something that I did a lot of research into a couple of years ago. And I remember one of the things that I was really interested to discover is that body dysmorphia, for example. So when we think of anorexia, we think of the image of a really, really thin woman, right? Yep. that was the image that we were fed back in the 90s or the early noughties. But actually an eating disorder can take shape on so many different forms. And I know that through the research that I did, that a lot of people that we would consider to be, you know, absolutely, you know, perfectly physically, so sports players, for example, or people who are really built big rugby players who are pure muscle, that can be someone who's also suffering from body dysmorphia.
Oh, yeah, because it doesn't have to be about your weight. It can be about your shape as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
As you know, so like I used to really, I hate my jawline. I'd hate a tiny little bear mark in my ear, like my wrists, you know what I mean? So as you said, like it can be.
The fixation, right, on some part of your physical.
Yeah, exactly.
So never, so my point there really is never underestimate, never assume that someone is fine. Because you never know what's going on. And I've heard of, like, you know, a particular thing among certain sports people is, or certain young lads, for example, who are, you know, obviously they're growing up, especially young guys today who are growing up in the world of Instagram and all that pressure as well. And I think, you know, social media really is the root of a lot of anxiety and a lot of pressures for people. And God, and I even know I can succumb to it myself. But it's like, you know, they can carb purge, so it's, again, it's trying to be big and big muscle, and then carb all this stuff that you kind of go, well, you've no idea what's going on with someone.
I had Barry from Bodywise on the podcast, we were saying to you earlier on, and he was saying something very similar to that. He said, like, there's nearly an epidemic of the whole protein and bulking up and all that. So exactly what you said, you have the an idea of an eating disorder where it's a skinny, you know, woman, but you, like as he said, it can go the other way as well. You know, so you've got the guys and the bulking up and the protein, and it's the way the protein is packaged and it's marketed to people, and you know, like it's a whole other ball game altogether. You know, Do you ever find any what's the word I'm looking for with social media, like a need to kind of just to post all the time or to have a certain look, or do you know what I mean?
Sometimes I do, I'm not gonna lie to you. And sometimes, you know, you do feel that you have to do certain things, but then there are other times where I'll just go quiet. I'm just like, actually no, I'm taking a step back from that because it feels just a bit unhealthy, or it's you know, focusing on the wrong things. So I'm very conscious as well of trying to use whatever platforms I have as a place to you know, share a bit of happiness and a bit of joy and nice things, you know? And I'd almost rather not, and I don't know if it's right or not, there occasionally I will talk about things that are, you know, maybe not perceived as being uplifting, but I'll only do it if I really feel that it's going to add value. You know, like, for example, I was, you know, I experienced someone shedded homophobic comments at me last year on the street in Dublin in broad daylight. And I was really taken aback. And I was like, so I, you know, I'll use my platform to kind of shed a light on that. I'm just kind of going, you know, that's not okay. But generally speaking, for, you know, I'm not someone who will be on, you know, talking about their bad customer service experience down in X and Y or whatever. Like, that's not, it's not how I want to fill my time. And I don't think anyone else, you know, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, you had an accident with a razor, didn't you? Well, I say accident, obviously. Yeah, I have a bit of a shave.
I butchered my own beard. I was growing a beard, and then I took a clump out of one side of it. I'm like, well, that's that gone now. So I clean shaven again.
Yeah, I was laughing when I saw that earlier because you said, like, you forgot your trimmer, and I did exactly the same before when it went away. I did exactly the same, and I could have just right here. I just was laughing when I saw you earlier.
I was like, feck that anyway.
Yeah.
There is something nice about letting the skin breathe as well.
Yeah, there is. I had a shave probably about a year ago, and the looks I got, I was like, no, that's never happening again.
Yeah, you have to be careful. You have to know what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, look, I think the stubble will have to stay on me for a while from the looks I got. Oh, Christ. Look, I think we've probably covered enough. We've probably got through an awful lot there. Is there anything else that you want to mention or talk about before we go?
No, that's all good.
Okay, right. Fair enough. Okay. Right, well then, maybe we'll let Aaron go off and grow some stubble for a while and we'll wrap this up. Right, guys, I'm going to shoot off and we'll be back very soon with another episode of the Endless Bar Podcast. Thanks, Darren.
Cheers, Keith. Love you talking to you.